Well, this is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And on the show today, we'll take a closer look at extending your gardening season with the use of covers. Our guest is Nikki Jabor. She is an award-winning author of 4 gardening books, and her latest book is Growing Undercover, Techniques for a More Productive, Weather-Resistant, Pest-Free Vegetable Garden. What questions do you have for Nikki? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us. And I know you are an experienced radio person also, and you just got done with recording your show. So thank you for being with us. That was a quick turnaround.
Yeah, you know what? It's so much fun. I love learning, and radio has been a great way to reach out and learn from so many people and just get inspired. So, again, I'm happy to be here and chat with you guys today.
Excellent. Well, you know, you've been gardening since you were pretty young. What got you interested?
You know, I think the fact that I grew up with a vegetable garden, and, you know, I should say it wasn't the most productive vegetable garden. It was pretty weedy. But the fact that my parents, you know, spent time every year putting this, you know, 15 by 20 foot vegetable garden in, it showed me that just the vegetables tasted so much better. And it became like such a fun project for us kids. You know, digging potatoes was a treasure hunt. But I also loved growing and picking the beans, the peas, the cucumbers. It was such a fun thing to have in our backyard. And you know what? I never looked back. I took it over probably by the time I was about 10 or 11. And I've been growing ever since.
That's amazing, because I grew up the same way, but the quicker I could get away from the garden, the better, until I was older and I could, you know, appreciate it. But yeah, I think it was the weeding part.
I get it.
Of it,
so. Yeah. Oh, I remember that too. It's a miracle. Yeah. I actually still like it.
Right. So tell us about your first experience using covers in the garden.
Yeah, gosh, I've been using different types of garden covers for, well, decades now. And it started really one autumn day when I was going up to the garden, my vegetable garden here in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And I was thinking, okay, I should plant the garlic soon. So I was going up and sort of taking a look at where I was going to plant my garlic crop. But when I got up to the garden, even though it had been a week or two since I'd been back in the garden, I thought pretty much everything would be dead. We'd had several frosts, so the season was over. That's what, you know, you garden between the frost dates. But I went up there and my arugula crop that we had been enjoying in like September was still going strong. And I was like, how is this even possible? So I covered it with a row cover that I often use in spring for tomatoes. And, you know, we had that arugula for probably 6 or 7 more weeks. And it was amazing to me.
That is
amazing.
And
you know what? And I started to think, well, if arugula can do this, what else can do this? What else can I grow that maybe is more cold tolerant? And then I started learning about mini hoop tunnels, and I started building and cold frames, and I just kind of fell down a rabbit hole, honestly.
Well, I kind of did the same thing when I was going through your book, because every question I had, you answered it, and it is such a thorough book. So thank you for writing it, because I know, you know, you can listen to a show like this and then say, oh, yeah, I'll remember that, and then you don't. So, yeah, this book is, like, really good reference. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Yeah, sure. I always tell myself I'm going to remember, and I never remember anything. So it's always good to have a reference.
It is, definitely. So besides, you know, lengthening the gardening season, what are some of the other benefits of using these covers?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many, really. And I know, I mean, we can certainly talk more about cold season extension and all the benefits of it and how it is really the only time I don't fight things like slugs and deer and flea beetles. But in terms of garden covers, like, it's not just about season extension. Yes, that's a fabulous part of using them, but it's also about the deer in my garden, the groundhogs in my garden, you know, the cucumber beetles and the squash bugs, all of these other things. Using garden covers makes it so much easier for me because they protect from these large and small pests. So to me, they've been like a game changer. I think of my garden covers as garden insurance against weather and pests. And even as a year-round vegetable gardener now, as someone who harvests, even though I'm in zone 5, all winter long, I'm planting in midsummer. Like, my carrots are planted for winter in late July, early August. You know, I'm planting radishes for winter and beets and things. And in the middle of summer, it can be hard to establish crops in the garden when the soil is so hot and dry. So using covers to create shade in the middle of summer also helps me establish succession crops, fall crops, winter crops. So There's just so many ways you can use garden covers to grow a healthier harvest.
It really makes a lot of sense. But one of the things that we usually get a question about when we do talk about covers is, what about pollinating? How do the little pollinators get in? So how do you solve that problem?
Yeah, I am all about the pollinators. My whole vegetable garden is designed for pollinators. If you looked at it, you might even say, is this a flower garden or a vegetable garden? Because there's about 15% flowers and 85% vegetables approximately. I welcome all sorts of pollinators to my garden because of course, more pollinators means more crops and particular things like cucumbers and melons and squash and pumpkins. So I do use garden covers over my squash for squash bugs and my cucumbers for cucumber beetles. But I put them on very early in the season when I first plant. And then, you know, as soon as I notice the plants are sizing up and beginning to flower, I do take those covers off. By that point, the plants are usually, they've gone through that teenage phase where they're a little more vulnerable to pests. So they've sized up and they're just a little more robust and vigorous. So at that point, I'm not as worried about them, you know, being damaged in a very impactful way by some of these pests. So I do take the covers off then to allow crops to be pollinated. But if I'm growing potatoes under a cover or cabbage or broccoli and I don't want cabbage worms on my crops, well, those crops don't have to be pollinated. So, you know, your cabbage, your broccoli, your cauliflower, your potatoes. So you can leave those covers in place, insect netting barriers, lightweight row covers, all summer long and not worry about those pests.
Well, and speaking of squash bugs, we have a call from Pat in Madison who has a question about them. Hi, Pat. What can we help you with?
Good morning. Thank you for the show. It's very relevant to my issue all summer. I'm going to get some covers now that I've learned about them, but I planted pumpkins, squash, white pumpkins, orange pumpkins, a variety of squash, and I had thousands of squash bugs. I don't know where they came from. I used organic soil. I bought my plants at the local Klein's Garden Center. Can you give me more information about where they come from and why they were only in my garden?
Well, I can guarantee you they weren't only in your garden.
Yep.
Yeah. And Jill, have you dealt with squash bugs a lot in your garden?
Actually, I don't grow very many vegetables. So I don't have to worry about those. But
oh, show off.
I know.
Well, squash bugs are a member of the stink bug family, and they feed on the plants, as I'm sure you've learned, by piercing the tissues with their needle-like mouth parts, and they basically suck out the plant sap. So they are a very common issue. They can fly into your garden. Unfortunately, they also can overwinter, underneath plant debris. So it's important to clean up your garden this fall so that plant debris is not left on the soil surface. You don't want to invite these guys back to your garden next year. And if you can, crop rotate. So make sure you plant your squash and cucumber family vegetables in a different garden bed, in a different spot next year. Cover them as soon as you plant with a row cover or like an insect barrier fabric you can buy at your garden centers or online. And that'll help prevent the issue from happening again because it is definitely a perennial issue. And it's the nymphs, the baby squash bugs, as well as the adults that feed on the plants and cause such terrible damage. I do know that, you know, once they're there, you can try to get rid of them in different ways, but they are very difficult to really get rid of. So keep an eye out for them. And again, if you do see them early in the season, take action. But crop rotating and using a garden cover can help prevent that problem in the first place. So that's what I would do next year.
Great. Thank you for that call, Pat, and good luck with those. If you have a question, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. And of course, you can send us an email, and that address is ideas@wpr.org. And that was another question that I had always had about covering. A lot of times you have like raised beds or, you know, specific cold frames. Is keeping that soil healthy? So what are some of the things that need to be done to do that?
Yeah, so obviously I mentioned crop rotation. So that's just planting your vegetables in a different spot from year to year. And I organize the crop rotation in my garden by family. So I don't plant like legumes like beans and peas in the same spot every year. I don't plant squash and cucumber family vegetables or tomato family vegetables in the same spot every year. Because obviously similar plants in the same family can deplete similar nutrients. They have similar nutrient needs. But also they're often, you know, fall prey to similar pests. So rotating your plants is good for the soil and pest prevention. So that's what one thing I do in terms of enriching my soil. And then the other thing is I do, and at this point I have 30 raised beds. I think I've gone a little out of control, but they're just so much lower maintenance that honestly, they're pretty easy to care for. So with my 30 raised beds, I approach soil care in that I want to feed the soil. The soil is everything to a healthy vegetable garden. So I just cleaned a few beds out yesterday. So what I did was I emptied those of their spent summer crops. I added a bunch of leaf mold compost, about an inch or so, to the top of the soil. And then I topped that with a bit of cow manure, aged cow manure. And that bed is now, you know, replanted with some lettuce for fall, some spinach for fall. So that's how I care for my soil. I feed it organic amendments and sometimes organic fertilizers. I do a soil test every year or two just to kind of see what my soil pH and soil nutrient levels are like. And that's just a nice guide to make sure you're on the right track.
Absolutely. Lots of good advice there. Now, let's start talking about the different kinds of covers. We mentioned a few, but why don't you kind of go over some of them, explain a little bit about what they are.
Yeah, there's a lot of types of garden covers you can use. And obviously, you don't need to use them all, but I would just find the ones that meet your needs the best. Basic garden covers include things like mulch. So, for example, if you have carrots or parsnips or beets or even leeks in your garden in late autumn, you can deep mulch them with about a foot or so, foot and a half, of straw or shredded leaves to prepare them for winter. And then you can harvest those all winter long. It just creates an insulating blanket on top of the soil to let you keep harvesting those crops. So that's a very basic, inexpensive type of garden cover. Then you've got things like row covers, which are spun bonded polypropylenes that you can use over your covers. They're very lightweight. They kind of look like tulle, like what you use for like a wedding veil, but they're very effective in the garden for insects as well as light frost. There's different weights of row covers, but then you also have clear plastics you can use to make mini hoop tunnels, essentially baby greenhouses over top your raised beds or in-ground gardens. And then, of course, you've got things like cold frames, which I think of as year-round food factories because I use my cold frames in so many different ways. And they're just bottomless boxes with clear tops. And then, of course, you've got walk-in structures like greenhouses, polytunnels, geodesic domes. These are all great types of garden covers you can use to really extend your season. Or if you're in a cold climate like me, and I know you're a little colder too sometimes in the winter, you can really create a microclimate around some of your crops and just grow healthier, more vigorous plants.
Great. Well, we're talking with Nikki Jabor. She is the author of Growing Undercover, Techniques for a More Productive, Weather-Resistant, Pest-Free Vegetable Garden. Joining the conversation, we have open lines, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Our on-air producer today is Clara Neipert, and Tyler Ditter is our technical director. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us every Friday or listen again on Saturday mornings at 6. You can also go online and listen to our archives at any point. Coming up next week, we'll talk about planting spring blooming bulbs with Lindsay Hendricks from the Green Bay Botanical Garden. That's next week on Garden Talk. Right now, we're talking vegetables and we're talking covers and how to extend your growing season. When you're talking about the different kinds of covers, how do you choose which one is best for whatever crop you're trying to grow?
Yeah, I guess it's best to think about what do you need a cover for? Are you trying to protect from frost when you've just planted your tomatoes in early spring? Because let me tell you, Jill, the minute I plant my tomatoes, I can tell you there'll be a frost that night. It's a guarantee. You know, I think most gardeners feel the same way.
Probably.
So putting a little mini... Right?
Yeah.
Putting a little mini hoop tunnel over top with a row cover or a sheet of clear plastic is a great way to prevent damage to your, you know, your tender tomatoes. So is that what you're trying to do? Or are you trying to maybe harvest into winter? Maybe you want to start with a cold frame. It's such a great structure for extending the season, you know, into fall, late fall, and even winter. But then you can also start planting in it again in like late February and harvest greens and root crops about, probably 6 to 8 weeks before you'd normally even plant them in your garden outside. So I would think about, what are your goals? Or are you trying to stop the deer from eating your bean plants? Your bush beans, in which case maybe you want a mini hoop tunnel with insect netting. So think about what you want to achieve, and then you'll easily find a cover to match that.
And we do get a lot of calls with people who are in a rural area, or even the city for that matter, with the deer, rabbit problems.
Yep.
What do you suggest for that?
Yeah, like, so, I mean, I live in a deer superhighway. I have at least a dozen deer that walk around or through my garden every day. So I don't mind them in the ornamental garden. I mean, that's fine. But in the vegetable garden, that's a no-go zone. So I do have an electric deer fence around my garden. But I do have a few beds of vegetables outside that fence. So for that, I just use, like, I just get half-inch PVC conduit. And, I talk about all these materials in the book, but I just bend them over top the beds, and then I top them with things like bird netting or chicken wire or insect barrier fabrics or lightweight row covers. And then you can leave those in place over top those hoops if you're protecting carrots or bush beans or cucumbers or whatever vegetables you're trying to protect for months, and the deer or the rabbits or the neighbor's dog can't access your vegetables.
Okay, well, great. Let's go back to the phones. We have Jeff in Berry Mills who has a comment or a question for us. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, I just wanted to share a tip I've been using for years for harvesting carrots for Christmas and New Year's. And after you get the first frost and the tops start dying back, and you get about a half inch to an inch of frozen ground on the top, I cover the whole row with piles of straw and leaves. And then you can go out and kick the stuff away in for Christmas dinner and dig up your carrots, and you've got some of the sweetest tasting carrots you'll ever eat.
Wonderful. Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah.
So he's definitely taking that to heart.
Yeah, the mulching works so great. And as he mentioned, they're really sweet. Like, we call those candy in the roots, and the same thing applies to beets and leeks and kale, but the starches in the roots convert to sugars as a natural antifreeze, so it just makes them taste that much sweeter. It's incredible.
Definitely want to try that. So in your book, you talk about systems that you use when you garden under cover. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, there's different ways to grow food undercover, and different types of covers, as we've mentioned. Some are temporary and in place just for a little bit of time. And some are, of course, long term, like my polytunnel I've had for almost 5 years now. It's 14 by 24 feet. And to me, that is just, it's my favorite space, to be honest. I love hanging out in there. And in there, I use different types of systems, whether it's for watering or ventilation, just to keep the environment healthy and growing well. And of course, I'm also feeding the soil in there too. I would just think about the types of covers you're using and all the different little tasks you need to do to keep those plants healthy. Because when you're growing under cover, whether it's a closed cold frame or a plastic covered mini hoop tunnel, or maybe it's a geodesic dome or a glass greenhouse or a polyethylene polytunnel like mine, the rainwater can't get to your crops if they're closed. So you have to make sure you provide the systems to make sure everything grows healthy under there. So that's basically the premise of that. But honestly, that polytunnel, every day of the year, it's my favorite place to be. Even in the middle of winter, there's about probably 15 different types of crops we're harvesting in there. And then in the summer right now, it is a tomato jungle, let me tell you. The temperatures tonight are getting a little too close to frost than I like. I mean, I think we still have a couple of weeks before that first frost, but at this time of year, it's possible. So having sheltered spaces for your vegetables really is nice to stretch the growing season and harvest season for so many types of crops.
And like you mentioned, you're in zone 5, and we are in zone 5 in the southern part of Wisconsin, and it kind of goes up and it depends. And you being close to the water, I'm sure, makes a difference on your when you get the cold, when you get the warm, that type
for
of
sure.
thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the water definitely keeps us a little warmer later, because Nova Scotia is almost an island surrounded by the ocean. So it keeps us warmer later in the fall, but it also keeps us colder in the spring. So, come March and April and even May, there's times early June, there's a pile of snow in the shade in my front yard still melting. So I get it.
We can relate, Lake Michigan and Lake Superior do the same thing for us here. So we can definitely.
Right.
Now, speaking of cold weather, what are some of the ways that you increase like heat retention in your frames or your hoop houses?
Yeah, well, there's lots of ways to increase heat. One of the things I often do is I double up layers. So as we just chatted about, mulching carrots, for example, if I have a cold frame full of carrots, often, come late December when the ground is starting to really freeze outside and the snow and winter's arrived, I'll fill that cold frame too with some shredded leaves. And that's just an extra insulating material in that cold frame, or some straw just to help make sure the ground doesn't freeze too deeply in that cold frame. Or in my polytunnel, I have two raised beds that are 3 feet wide that run along along the sides of the tunnel. So I'll make little mini hoop tunnels with simple wire hoops and row cover over top the greens and the root crops that are growing there. Just to add, again, a little bit of extra layer of insulation for those really cold winter months of January and February. So those are some things I do. But in a cold frame, you could also add a little heat sink, maybe a couple bottles of water, some 1 gallon bottles of water along the back of the cold frame. They'll absorb the sun's, you know, heat during the day and then release it at night. And it just makes for a less intense temperature plunge when darkness falls. So it just kind of allows some of that heat to radiate out and keep the cold frame just a little bit warmer than the outside temperature. In a bigger structure like a greenhouse or a polytunnel, sometimes people use rocks and as pathways, and they'll absorb heat during the day as well. And again, radiate it out during the night, or people will have a rock wall against the back of their structure, or even just a bunch of barrels of water or a big reservoir of water, and that will also absorb heat and it radiated out at night as a heat sink. So there's lots of options for kind of playing around with that. But in all my structures, I use no supplemental heating. So I don't use any forms of electricity to heat my cold frames, my mini hoop tunnels, or my polytunnel at night. So I'm relying completely on Mother Nature and just being as sneaky as I can be.
And I would imagine that years of experience has helped you figure out what you can do in each one and at what time, right? Yeah, lots of experimentation.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I keep track of temperatures. I've got little, you know, thermometers everywhere. I was saying, okay, well, it's sunny today, but yesterday was, you know, like a cloudy and a few degrees cooler. So what was the inside of this cold frame? You know what I mean? I love to do that.
Well, you have to keep track of everything.
Yes.
Do you have a question about covering your vegetables or extending your growing season or vegetables in general? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or again, you can call or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So we talked about mulching a little bit. Are there specific things that you shouldn't use for mulching?
I'm one of those economical gardeners, so I like to use things that are either free or really inexpensive. So I'm all about the straw bales that I can source this time of the year quite cheaply, but also leaves. I mean, here in my municipality, you know, a lot of people chop up their leaves or just bag them up and put them on their curb for pickup, and then our municipality turns that into compost we can then go get. But I just want to keep my leaves and the leaves of all my neighbors, so I'm a bit of a leaf thief, and I go around taking leaves from everybody, and then I chop them up with my lawnmower, and then all of those chopped up leaves. I have big bins along my garden that I compost them into leaf mold, but that's also what I'll use for mulching materials. So super, super easy to do. But, you know, one other thing I'd love to hear about, Jill, from your listeners is, you know, now that we're kind of at the, I hate to say, the end of the traditional growing season, I love to hear what their favorite varieties are and their favorite crops to grow, because I'm always looking as a food gardener for new varieties to try. So I love to hear what people's favorite tomatoes are, or what cucumber was their absolute must grow, or things like that, if anybody has suggestions for us.
Excellent. Yeah, we'd definitely like to hear that. Again, 800-642-1234. We've got open lines, so give us a call. You'll get in right away. Talk about some maintenance. Now, these hoops are wonderful, but I'm sure you have to take care of them and order them to work. So what's involved that way?
You know, in terms of cold frames, it's pretty easy. Most of my cold frames I make from untreated local hemlock, which is a very rot-resistant wood, very similar in terms of its, you know, strength and durability to cedar, but so much cheaper. So that's what I make my frames from. And they last about 10 years, so that's pretty good. You can use, of course, double-sided twin-wall polycarbonate, or, you know, an old window as a top for a cold frame, an old shower door. There's lots of options. So they tend to last quite a long time. Mini hoop tunnel materials, actually, the hoops themselves are surprisingly durable. So for the most part, for the past 20 plus years, I've been using half-inch PVC conduit, which comes in 10-foot lengths from your hardware stores, and I just bend them over the beds. And because it's such a strong type of plastic, I still have some of the original ones I started using 20 years ago.
Wow.
So it's a great material, because I'm trying to limit my plastic use. So if I'm going to use something in my garden, I want to make sure it's going to last a very long time before I recycle it. So I only choose resilient materials. And as for covers for the mini hoop tunnels, well, yes, you can use cheap, clear plastics like a drop cloth you'd use if you paint at your house, for example. But they don't last very long at all. So I choose to use greenhouse plastics, which last about 4 to 6 years and they're UV treated. So they really tend to be very durable material. So I try to think about that when I'm choosing materials, because in the long run, that's so much cheaper than buying inexpensive materials that only last a single season. So I try to invest in my garden things that will be very durable, that will last a long time, and then when I'm finished with them, I can recycle.
And I know someone's going to want to know, where can you get this greenhouse plastic?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm lucky enough to have a greenhouse supply store in my city, but, you know, you can buy the stuff, of course, online. Lots of garden supply and greenhouse supply companies sell it online as well, like Gardener Supply, like Johnny Seeds. So they're not, it's not hard to source, you know, for sure. If you don't have a greenhouse supply store in your area, then you definitely can order online. And of course, many of these companies mail order and send packages out, so it's not too tricky, especially now. It seems like we don't shop in person anymore. It's all mail order at this point.
I know. I get so many things delivered to my house. I got a canoe the other day.
Oh, my.
Well, it's actually,
wow, that's awesome. Yes,
it's an origami kayak. So we'll see how that goes, but it should be interesting. Anyway, we've got another caller, Bruce in Algoma. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning. Question regarding quality of seed. I think that the quality over the years has gone down. I had spinach this year that I planted 5 times. The germination rate was terrible. It's new seed. Then I had green beans that had 3 different varieties in them. It had flat beans. It had some kind of a I'm looking for Blue Lake, Bush Blue Lake, and I'm getting all this strange stuff. Your comment, please.
Nikki, I think your audio just dropped out. Oh, there she is. She's back again. Oh, no, she dropped out again. I'm really sorry. She is coming from Canada. So, you know, sometimes things aren't going to work as well over long distances. Our guest today is Nikki Jabor. She's an award-winning author of 4 gardening books, and she writes for magazines across North America, and she's a founding member of the award-winning website SavvyGardening.com, and you really should check out that website. There are so much good information on there. And Nikki, do we have you back? Can you hear us, Nikki? Nope. Not yet. Okay. Well, we'll let Tyler deal with that because that's his job. again, that's SavvyGardening.com. And she also has a radio show, too. And you can get that streaming online. She is a year-round vegetable gardener, and she grows food in over, well, now she said, I think, 40 raised beds in Halifax, Nova Scotia. So are we ready to go with Nikki? Nope, still not getting audio. I'm really sorry. But we do, you can take this time to give us a call. So 800-642-1234, or you can send an email, ideas@wpr.org. So we're going to try to get her on phone. But just to let you know, Monday, we're going to be talking to our physical therapist. Jill and Lori are back, and they're going to be talking about how to treat and prevent everyday neck pain. I'm sure we all get a pain in the neck from different things. So that'll be great. Monday on the Ideas Network, starting at 11 and going till 12:30. And obviously, we're having a little bit of technical problem right now, but we'll be able to take your calls soon, hopefully. And our lines are full, and Claire's doing her best to get those calls and get Nikki back online right now. Again, her book is Growing Undercover, Techniques for a Productive, Weather-Resistant, Pest-Free Vegetable Garden. Nikki, are you back?
I think so.
Yay.
Hi. Can you hear me? Sorry, I've been here the whole time. I don't know what happened.
The audio just dropped out, and then the video dropped out, and so we're good now. So let's just
sorry
continue.
About that.
No problem. It
yes,
happens.
Please. I'm sorry. I only heard half the seed question, but the gentleman mentioned that he finds the seeds maybe aren't as viable as they used to be. I think he mentioned.
That's correct. And then Bruce, are you still there, Bruce in Algoma?
Oh,
Bruce. Nope. Oh, he dropped off. Sorry. But he said one
sorry,
of the
Bruce.
Problems was that he had to reseed a number of times. And also he was trying to grow a certain kind of green bean, I believe it was. And in the package, there were like three different types of seeds, and he wasn't getting what he was supposed to get. So,
gosh. Well, it's funny. I did grow green beans myself this year as well. And I had three varieties in it, but in the seed pack, but that was actually something that I wanted because I wanted to grow a trilogy of beans. So assuming that would just be a mistake of the seed company. You know what I mean?
Right.
If you're getting different varieties in a seed pack. So I don't know what seed company that would be, but I can't say it's super uncommon to have a different variety accidentally in a pack. So that's probably what happened there. But in terms of the spinach not germinating, and I think he said he tried to replant it several times as well. You know, I don't find, like, I order from probably a half dozen seed companies every year. I haven't found a problem in terms of quality, for sure. But I do also order from seed companies that I love and that are reliable, that I know are great quality companies, including several of our local heirloom seed companies here in the East Coast of Canada. And I know those folks are putting a lot of TLC into growing the varieties and saving the seeds. So I would say maybe talk to the seed company if you can. Ask them, you know, tell them what happened and maybe ask them where they think it could have gone wrong, you know, and then maybe switch to some companies that you've heard are maybe more reliable.
And in a case of seeds, I know you can pick them up rather inexpensive. I mean, at some places you just wouldn't think about buying seeds. And in that case, do you generally get what you pay for? Is paying a little bit more a good idea?
Oh, you are spot on, Jill. I mean, I can buy seeds from my dollar store or even my hardware store, but I'm going to buy seeds from a local seed company or I'm going to buy seeds from a reliable national seed company, you know, one that I know is putting in the time, the work, the research into their varieties. So, yeah, it is definitely what you get what you pay for. And to be honest, seeds aren't cheap.
No.
You know, that used to be, you know, 79 cents a seed pack, but average price of a seed pack now, if you're buying from a good quality seed company, is probably close to $4. But you probably have enough in there for a year or two at least. So, and of course you can go to seed exchanges, seed swaps, things like that as well. Cause you know, if you open a packet of tomatoes, you don't need 80 seeds. Maybe you just need four.
Oh, but you really want to plant all those, don't you? And then you're like,
I do.
What am I going to do with all of these?
Totally. Yeah. So I would also share with like-minded gardeners. And you know, garden clubs are a great place for that as well. Many garden clubs share the cost of seed orders, or that you can kind of go in and do a seed swap. So that's fun as well.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And lots of libraries around here are doing that too. So let's go back to the phones. We've got Patty in Fond du Lac County who has a comment for us about those seeds. Hi, Patty.
Hi. Well, you just said so much stuff I was going to tell this gentleman. You know, you have to go to reputable seed sources, number one.
Yeah.
If you don't, you're going to end up with what's happening to him. And I also recommend that you do local as possible, because their seeds are tested in the same zones that you live. Mm-hmm. So they should work the best.
That's such a good point. Such a good point.
Absolutely. Thank you, Patty. We appreciate that. Next, we have Philothea in Viroqua with a question. Hi, Philothea.
Hi, I'm really enjoying this show and this guest. Thank you so much.
Great.
I'm interested in crop covers, I mean seed covers. Mm-hmm. Do you talk about that at all, and when to plant them, how to use them, and what you have the best success with?
Well, now, I'm just not sure what you mean by seed covers. Do you mean like using like row covers to get things started extra early, or what do you mean exactly?
Crops, excuse me. I mean cover crops.
Okay.
Oh, cover crops. I got you. Yes. I'm a big fan of cover crops. I don't write about them too much in my most recent book. I do write about them a little bit. And one way I like to use cover crops, I do use them sometimes in my polytunnel to enrich the soil, but I also use them in my cold frame. So when I finish harvesting from a cold frame, you know, say in late April, early May, just as summer starting to settle in, I will then seed a cover crop like buckwheat or something like that in my cold frame, let it grow until it starts to flower, chop it down, let it decompose, add a bit of compost. And then by July, I'm starting to plant again if I want something like carrots for fall and winter. So cover crops, you know, even in my garden right now, there's about probably a quarter of my beds that are planted in cover crops, because I'm so glad you brought it up. They're such a great way and an inexpensive way to enrich the soil.
Do you have any favorite cover crops, Nikki?
I I really like using buckwheat because it's so quick to grow, and then I just chop it down. And sometimes I'll let it flower for a couple days because the bees love it so much. But I don't let them flower long enough to set seeds because then it gets a little promiscuous in the garden, Jill, if you know what I mean.
I like that. Promiscuous in the garden. I'm going to use that. That's great. Thank you, Philothea. That was a great question. Next up, we have Colette in Eagle River. Hi, Colette.
Hi. I have a question with hoop houses you mentioned. We live way up north in northern Wisconsin, so we have cold climate too. And we bought a pretty big hoop house from Amazon. Worked out well, except we didn't get much crops from it. The first year we planted peppers and tomatoes, and we had 6-foot tomato plants, but the bees wouldn't go in, even though we had it open. So I tried using a spray to pollinate, and we got very few tomatoes. This year I thought, we'll take the tomatoes out, put them back in the garden. And let's try peppers, because I have a hard time growing peppers up here. It's too cold. And this year, it's like they just didn't do anything. They just sort of sat there. We maybe got 2 peppers out of 30 plants, and they just didn't do anything. And we kept them watered, and it was warmer in there. We're not quite sure what we did wrong. We have a hard time growing peppers. We're old season gardeners, but we moved farther north from where we were, and it's like, it's sort of really, it's an adjustment.
Peppers are hard.
They are. And, I live in a cold climate, and 20 years ago, I had such trouble growing them. But now with the climate crisis, we're much warmer than we used to be, and I don't have trouble growing peppers anymore. But I think I know what your problem was, and it's not your fault. You didn't do anything wrong. The problem was heat. When the temperature inside a structure or in a garden gets too hot, tomatoes and peppers will not pollinate and they drop their flowers. So you might only get 1 or 2 fruits, if any, from the plants if it's too hot. So it's going to be really important to make sure the structure is opened as wide as it can be, doors, windows, if it's a hoop house, the sides rolled up, get that air flowing through there to get that temperature down, and you should see much better fruit set. I also do plant a few flowers in my polytunnel to welcome bees inside, because then they'll come in and then they'll be like, oh, well, while I'm here, maybe I'll just pollinate this tomato at the same time. So I do that as well, and it helps. But if all else fails, again, you can hang some shade cloth over top to help reduce the temperature as well. You can use an electric toothbrush and just kind of put it, like touch it to your tomato, like flowers and pepper flowers for like 1 or 2 seconds, and that'll help them self-pollinate and produce their fruits too.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. I want to see video.
All right, I'm going to go there right now.
Okay. Thank you so much, Colette. And, let us know how it goes next year. That's a really interesting question. Our guest today on Garden Talk is Nikki Jabor. She is the author of Growing Undercover, Techniques for a More Productive, Weather-Resistant, Pest-Free Vegetable Garden, among other books. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nagel. I hope you can join us next week on Garden Talk. We'll be talking about planting spring blooming bulbs and also a little bit about English country gardens with Lindsay Hendricks from the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. Right now, we're talking about vegetables with Nikki Jabor. And I think we got all of our audio and video problems set, Nikki, right?
I think so. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can definitely hear you. Thank you. And let's go right back to the phones. And if you have a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And we've got Lisa in Amberg who has a question. Hi, Lisa.
Yes, I have a solution and a question. My backyard, they were putting a new septic system in when we moved in. And the people didn't really understand how soil structure is. And instead of putting layers of soil back in, they just jumbled everything together. So my whole backyard is nothing but subsoil. So instead of fighting with all of that, we went ahead and put raised beds in, and I dug a trench inside the beds and laid rotted logs for hugel culture, and then leveled it off with compost and have used it this year. I expect it'll probably be more fertile over the next few years. So that was our solution for the garden. But the question I have is, I'm trying to incorporate more native perennial greens and roots and that are edible. Is there a good tea that I could use to help me identify some of these wild perennial vegetables?
That's a good question. Now, I'm not sure for your neck of the woods. I know there's certainly some apps people use here for their phones for that in the east coast of Canada, but I'm not so sure where you're located in terms of, you know, a resource for that. There are some good books about perennial edibles out there as well, and I know I have a couple on my bookshelf that are really helpful. You know, so I would probably also drop by your local library to see if there's any books that interest you, and then if you really find them helpful, you could, of course, order a copy. But I'm afraid I'm not sure of local resources for ones that would be native in your region.
Yeah, and Lisa, we've talked over the years to a couple of experts on wild edibles. So if you go to WPR.org/Larry or basically anywhere and just Google wild edibles, you're going to see a number of shows that come up, not only ours, but some of the others too. So, and I believe most of those were Wisconsin-based. So that'll be helpful for you too. So good luck with that.
That's... And I have to say, I love the fact that you're doing Kugel culture in your raised beds, though, because that is the exact right thing to be doing when you're filling raised beds, especially over a septic field. So that's a great tip for anybody listening now, wondering what to fill a raised bed with. So great advice from you.
And why don't you explain that a little bit, because I'm not familiar with it. Nikki.
Well, it's such a, so my raised beds are about 16 inches tall. You can make raised beds, of course, any height you want, but then you're like, what do I fill them with? I see people with, you know, 3 foot tall raised beds, and that's a lot of soil to pay for if you're going to be filling them with garden soil, as well as the fact that buying, you know, created manufactured soil, which is pretty much what we get now when we buy soil, you know, it's just, it's not that great. So when you can make your own, it's a bit of a slower process, but over the years, it really pays off. So you start with larger woody materials like logs and large sticks, and then you put smaller sticks there. You could add leaves, compost, you know, even like some kitchen scraps and garden scraps in there. You're basically creating almost like a lasagna-type garden, but one that starts with very large, slow-to-break-down materials like the logs. And as they break down over the years, they almost become quite spongy in nature. So they actually hold a lot of moisture, which is fantastic because then your garden is going to be more drought tolerant and resilient in hot weather. So there's many benefits of using, besides the fact you're saving money by not buying soil, there's many benefits of creating a raised bed this way.
Excellent. Well, thank you. And thank you, Lisa, very much for bringing that up to us. Let's go next to Marilyn in the South Range. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I'm in the process of moving raspberries. Our old raspberry bed was a raised bed, and it worked well for weeding, but the grasses and, well, I think it was goldenrod has kind of tried to get in there. And I need a mulch for around the plants, and, you know, because they're going to spread a little bit, but I don't mind them spreading into that plot. But I need something to keep the weeds down. Do you have any ideas?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, raspberries are such a vigorous plant. I like to grow mine on trellises using like a T, sort of a wooden like T at the end of the bed, and then I run wires to another T, and then they kind of keeps them upright. And, you know, if they're in a raised bed by themselves, it prevents them from spreading. Some people would use different types of garden edging if it was an in-ground garden to kind of keep those roots where they want them to be and under control. That works well. And then when it comes to mulching the soil, I would be using something probably like a bark mulch, bark nuggets, nothing too shredded already because that breaks down so quickly. So I would use something like large size chunks or nuggets that will take probably 2 to 3 years to break down at least, and of course help reduce the amount of weeds and problems you're going to get there. Unfortunately, you do have to get rid of all the weeds first, because if you put mulch or something on top of weeds, especially tenacious perennial weeds, they're just going to come right up through it. So I would definitely you know, get rid of as many weeds as you can. Trim your raspberries like how you want them to be, if you know, to make sure they're in the place you want them to be, and then put the mulch down. I wouldn't use a landscape fabric. That just I find that like ties everything up and the roots will get tangled in it, and it just makes a bigger mess. It's not great. You could put down sheets of newspaper a couple layers deep before you put down you know, the mulch, or cardboard with no plastic tape left attached to it, of course. But I wouldn't use landscape fabric. Cardboard or newspaper, and then your layer of mulch.
Good luck with that, Marilyn. Do you grow a lot of berries on your?
I try.
Okay, and how does that work out?
Well, I mean, I've been in this house for 22 years, and for most of those 22 years, my backyard has been half vegetable garden and half very sad looking lawn. So last spring, I decided to get rid of the sad looking lawn, which was about 2,000 square feet, so it was pretty big.
Yeah.
And I rented a tractor for a weekend, and I had a lot of fun. And I dug up that lawn, and then I planted native shrubs, native perennials like milkweed for the monarch butterflies, and berries. I planted things like Saskatoon service berries and strawberries and blueberries and raspberries. And so they're only about a year and a half old now. But my goodness, if we haven't had already so many berries coming in this year, because I want them, obviously, for me and my family, but also for the birds. Just digging up that grass in my backyard and having no more turf back there has brought in so many species of birds, as well as butterflies and native bees, that, I mean, again, one year, the change has been just incredible. So I do try to plant a lot of berries, and I have more plans to add to that as well.
They're wonderful because it's just such instant gratification to go out there and grab a berry. Do you have any questions about raising berries or vegetables or using covers in your garden? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or, of course, you can send an email to ideas@WPR.org. And we did get an email from Carrie in Duluth. She couldn't stay with us, but she grows Big Beef, Early Girl, and Sun Sweet Cherry Tomatoes, as well as Nokia, N-O-K-Y-A, Asian Cucumbers in her 16x16 hoop house. She plants in containers by necessity and mixes her own soil. Is there a good way to make sure that she's making a mix with the right nutrients?
Well, that's a really good question for sure. You know, and when I'm growing vegetables, if I'm growing them in containers, I like to use a lightweight, you know, potting mix. I'll buy a high-quality potting mix. And then I mix that about 50-50 with either my homemade compost or some aged manure that I've brought in, and then as well as a slow-release organic vegetable fertilizer. So I'll mix in that granular fertilizer with the compost, with the potting mix, fill my containers, and then, you know, probably about 6 weeks later, I'll sprinkle on another application of that slow-release organic vegetable fertilizer just to make sure those plants have all the nutrients they need. And another thing I like to do is I do buy liquid kelp. You know, you can buy different types of liquid seaweed mixes, and they contain so many plant hormones and micronutrients. So maybe every month or so, I'll just add some to a watering can and just give all of the containers in my own greenhouse a dose, and they just respond so quickly. Within a day or two, they just get deeper green. They just love liquid kelp. So I do that as well. And that should keep your plants growing very well. But it sounds like she's growing some amazing varieties. I'm a huge fan of Sun Gold tomatoes as well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Carrie. We really appreciate that. And she's in Duluth, which is pretty darn cold. So I'm sure that hoop house has made a big difference for her. So,
nice.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your website, savvygarden.com. Like I said, there's so much really good information. Kind of an unusual, you're not the only person who contributes, are you?
I'm not yet. Savvy Gardening. And we started it about, I think, 8 years ago now with two people I admire so much, Jessica Walliser, who is a best-selling author, two-time winner of the American Horticultural Society Book Award, a fellow horticulturist and garden nerd. But she loves talking about bugs, good bugs, bad bugs, pollinators, science-based companion planting. And then my other partner, Tara Nolan, who is also from Canada, from Toronto. And she is an ornamental expert, containers, you know, raised bed expert. She's the author of Raised Bed Revolution. So the three of us write for Savvy Gardening, and it's all science-based gardening information. At this point, we get about 1.5 to 2 million people a month visiting the website, plus more, of course, coming to us through Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and Pinterest. So we're all about giving people solid information as well as providing lots of inspiration, too.
And we've had Jessica with us a couple of times with her books, that all, again, good. And you can go to our website and find those and listen to those. So I noticed one of the latest articles that you wrote was on growing garlic, as you had mentioned earlier. Why don't you share some tips for that in the last few minutes before we go to news?
Yeah, garlic is one of the easiest crops to grow, really, and it does take a long time. You can plant it in the spring, but if you really want the big bulbs, and I do, I plant it in the fall. So you don't plant it yet. It's a little bit too early. About a month before the ground freezes, maybe 6 weeks at most, is ideal. So I'm planting garlic in my Zone 5 garden, usually in late October. And, you know, I grow hardneck garlic. There's two types, hardneck, softneck. I grow hardneck because that's the most cold-hardy different types to grow in variety. So that's what I grow in my northern garden. And, again, planting it late, amending the soil with compost and some slow-release organic vegetable fertilizer. And then, you know, you plant them about 2-3 inches deep, 6 inches apart. If you want them to be really big, you could even go 8 inches apart for the cloves. And then I mulch them with shredded leaves or straw for the winter. And then come spring, they pop out of the soil pretty quickly. And then I give them another dose of fertilizer. And my gosh, we harvest the scapes come early summer and the bulbs in midsummer. And there's nothing like the flavor of homegrown garlic. If you've only ever had supermarket garlic, your mind will be blown. So I urge you to plant some garlic this fall.
Well, I didn't realize it was so easy. So I think maybe we'll get some people doing that. I've noticed even getting garlic at the farmer's market as compared to in the grocery store, it's a huge difference too. So
huge, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, again, 800-642-1234. If you have any questions, give us a call. And just quickly, Barbara sent us an email to ask, what is the best way to overwinter a raised garden bed?
Oh, that's a great question. So assuming she's just thinking of putting it to bed for the winter, I mean, if she had crops still in there that were cold hardy, like spinach or kale, I would put a mini hoop tunnel over top. If she's thinking of just, you know, putting the bed to, you know, the garden to bed for winter, then I would just top it with some compost, some shredded leaves, something to hold the soil in place and prevent soil erosion, as well as let the winter snows and rains work those nutrients down into the soil. So I usually top it with some sort of organic material, followed by shredded leaves or straw. And then, honestly, that's it. Let it do its thing over winter, and then you can start planting again in the spring.
Simple enough. Our guest today on Garden Talk is Nikki Jabor. She is the author of 4 gardening books, including Growing Undercover, Techniques for a More Productive, Weather-Resistant, Pest-Free Vegetable Garden. Stay with us. There's always more to come right here on the Ideas Network. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. On the show today, we're talking about vegetable gardening and how to extend the season with the use of covers. Our guest is Nikki Jabor, an award-winning author of 4 gardening books. She writes for magazines across North America and is a founding member of the award-winning website SavvyGardening.com. And Nikki is a year-round vegetable gardener who grows food in over 40 raised beds in Halifax, Nova Scotia. So what questions do you have about gardening with covers, like row covers or cold frames, shade cloth even? And what other vegetable questions do you have? You can join in by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So, Nikki, we've talked about bugs, and we talked about some of the other things with growing under a cover, but what about disease? Is that something that you're going to get more of or less? Or what's the scoop on that?
That's a really good question. I think preventing diseases is all about, well, good garden sanitation and proper spacing of plants. For example, a lot of people complain about powdery mildew on their squash and zucchini plants or even cucumbers, which is so common, particularly in late summer. But proper spacing so that air can really circulate around those leaves and dry them off quickly after a rain or after you irrigate is very important. So for garden covers, I have fewer diseases in my polytunnel than I do in my garden because it's protected in that the rain doesn't fall on those plants and keep the leaves wet, which, you know, on a cloudy day or rainy day, if it's wet for a couple days, that's when many diseases can kind of begin or spread through splashing water. So having a cover like a mini hoop tunnel or a greenhouse over top can help prevent that. Now, when I do water in my polytunnel or, gosh, even in my garden, I always use a long-handled watering wand or a soaker hose, and I direct the water to the soil, not the leaves of the plant, because, again, that's what can spread disease. So that's important. Also, good air circulation. So if you're using garden covers, whether it's in spring to prevent frost or overtop potatoes in summer to keep the potato bugs out, you want to use something that's going to let good air flow through. And insect netting, garden netting, lightweight row cover definitely lets that happen. So it's all about choosing the right cover for the right job, and that'll definitely help reduce disease as well.
And what are your thoughts on maybe pruning back some of the leaves, the foliage on the plants? I know some people really do that on tomatoes, but I've heard pros and cons on that. What are your thoughts?
You know, it's funny. I have been doing that lately, actually, quite a bit still in my greenhouse mainly. That the garden crops. So I do prune my tomatoes throughout the growing season. So in my greenhouse, the tomatoes are grown up, strings or stakes, and I try to train them to a two-stem system. So, when they start growing by early summer, the first sucker develops beneath that, first flower cluster. Mm-hmm. And I let that first sucker develop because that's usually a really vigorous one. So then I have my two stems. And then all the other suckers after that I'll pinch out. Because when I'm growing things vertically, I do want to have good air circulation. I don't want a tomato plant like an indeterminate tomato plant just to become a tangle of leaves because that really invites disease because, the inside of the plant doesn't dry out quickly and it gets shaded. And so that's an invitation to so many different types of diseases. So I like to grow things vertically, but right now I am pruning back any flower clusters on tomato plants because let's get real, they're not going to have time to produce tomatoes for me. Even small little knobby tomatoes that aren't going to grow into giant slicers, they're gone. I'm also removing maybe about a third of the leaves just to increase the light to the fruits that are still ripening on the plants to help speed that up. So yes, I'm definitely doing that now. It does, I find, help short season gardeners. And actually, I started doing that about 3 weeks ago for certain types of tomatoes, the large slicers, just to give those remaining fruits time to size up. So, and also, I've slowed watering down of my tomato plants because I don't want the tomatoes that are ripening to split. So, I start to grow them a little drier this time of the year, too.
Well, that makes a lot of sense because they do like to split right in the fall, too, don't they? Right when you're just going to go to pick them.
Oh, don't they, though? I tell you, actually, my secret to making sure that doesn't happen for my big slicers, and I just picked two 2-pound tomatoes today, Lebanese mountain tomatoes. They're giant red slicers. These will make the most sublime sandwich you've ever had. So what I do is I pick them when they're half ripe, and then I bring them indoors to finish ripening up, because once a tomato is fully ripe in the garden, that is not only prone to splitting and cracking, but it's very attractive to chipmunks and squirrels and deer and rabbits who are drawn in by the smell of a fully ripe tomato. So that's one thing I like to do, pick my large slicers before they're 100% ripe.
That's true, and they always just take one bite and leave, right? So
why do they do that to us? I don't understand.
Well, we'd have a phone call. Josh in Eau Claire has a question. Hi, Josh.
About a white currant, I think they're either a grape or a cherry tomato on a WPR program. And I was really interested in them and tried to get them to grow this springtime. I started them indoors in little cubes. They all popped up and grew to about 1 or 2 inches high, but then every single one I had just suddenly died. Wondering what I did wrong and what I might be able to do better.
Yeah, okay. White currant tomato is a pretty cool variety to grow. They're not really white. They're like a pale kind of yellowish in color, but they're very delicious. So, starting the seeds indoors, I find air circulation is key, or else they can fall prey to something called damping off, which is a common seedling disease that just causes those little seedlings to plop over like that. So, providing lots of light. And if you have a grow light, I would use that instead of a sunny window because you'll just get sturdier seedlings. B, don't water too much. Try to keep the soil lightly moist but not soaking wet because that, of course, can also prompt disease and cause the seedlings to rot, and then creating good air circulation. My secret, because I start all my seeds in my basement, which is not great for air circulation, so I always have a little fan, a little oscillating fan just going back and forth, just like a $10 fan, and that creates nice airflow, and that, for me, has been just such a game changer the past few decades for growing seedlings. So I do have a little fan that really helps as well. So I would recommend trying some of those things.
Well, good luck, Josh. I hope that that works for you next year, because that's so disappointing when you put all that work and hope into those little seedlings and then they just die. So
we've all been there too. I mean, all been there. Sometimes, you know, sometimes some of these seeds come with disease already, you know, and that, I mean, it's rare, but it's possible. You could do everything right and this can still happen. So don't get discouraged, but please do try again.
Yes, that's the key to gardening, is don't get discouraged and try again. Do you have a question for Nikki? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we're talking about watering. Now, how do you, some of your covers, the water comes through, but some of them don't. So you have to actually go in there and water. How often do you have to water, or how do you judge when you need to water?
The question I think I'm asked most about my winter garden is, how often am I watering in the winter? Because I think that horrifies people, the thought that they might have to water a cold frame or a greenhouse in the winter. So the truth is, I don't. I don't water in the winter. So from late December, usually until early February, I don't have to water my mini hoop tunnels, my mulch beds, my cold frames, or my greenhouse, because it's just too cold outside. And, you know, when it's that cold, your vegetables aren't actively growing. There's less light. They're not transpiring and using up that moisture, so you just don't have to water as much. Now, that said, usually in February, we get a February thaw for a couple days, and temperatures can climb above freezing and almost become like that fake spring that gets us all so excited
yes.
before it plunges back into the icy depths again. So at that point, I'll go and check. I'll say, hey, you know, are things looking a little dry? If so, I will deep water. Or if we have that sort of thaw and it's raining, I will open a cold frame top, or I'll take off the cover of a mini hoop tunnel and let Mother Nature water for me. But generally, I don't have to water during those very frigid months, but then I do start watering once spring starts to get on the horizon. I'll start deep watering in the greenhouse again, because at that point, I'm also cleaning out any of the winter crops we ate. They're pretty much done, if not done completely. And then I'll amend the soil, I'll deep water, and I'll start planting again in mid-February, things like spinach and kale and chard and carrots and beets and scallions and so on and so on. So that's generally how I approach watering. So I try to maintain a lightly moist soil for the most part in my garden, you know, try to avoid overwatering, try to avoid underwatering. And in terms of trying to maintain soil moisture and conserve water, I do rely on mulches a lot. Like, I mulch my tomato plants in summer, pepper plants, cucumbers, squash. Most of my vegetable crops are mulched with straw or shredded leaves just to hold that soil moisture and reduce how much I have to water, because I don't want to be out there every day watering my garden.
Well, you don't have anything better to do than, you know, watering your plants all
water
the time.
Water 40 beds every day.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Now, when it comes to, like, this time of year, or you're starting to, things are slowing down and it's getting darker earlier, do you then stop watering as much, or do you continue to keep that ground nice and moist?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't had a deep, normally we would have rain consistently in the Maritime Provinces. Rain is just something that happens during the summer and spring and fall. I haven't had a deep rain in my garden since late June at this point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you get a sprinkle, or we've had like a 10-minute downpour, which of course doesn't absorb into the soil, so that's useless.
No.
I hear rain's coming this week, but I've been told that a lot, and I haven't. So I'm skeptical at this point. So I have been deep watering the vegetable garden only once every 2 weeks, for the most part because I'm relying on my mulches. I'm trying to conserve water. And if things didn't thrive, then they didn't thrive. The things I have still watered are newly planted seed beds. So I planted spinach a couple days ago, and more baby kale and more arugula and lettuce. So I did water those, the newly planted things, for the seeds to germinate and establish. But I'm trying to water not very much, and instead use things like mulch to hold that soil moisture. It's a challenge, but I think as, you know, the climate continues to warm, we are going to have to learn to be gardeners that can adapt to drought and higher temperatures as well, and grow varieties that can withstand that, which is one of the reasons one of your earlier callers mentioned about growing local seeds from local seed companies. And that's absolutely true. They're going to have the same varieties that maybe a company from like Florida or California would have. You could buy the same Cherokee purple tomato, for example, but the ones that were grown in your own area are specifically adapted to your local climate, and they are just going to do better than that same variety bought from a Florida seed company. So sticking to local seeds, I think, is going to be extremely important going forward.
Okay. Now, we've got a question from Dell in Waupun. Hi, Dell.
Hello. You talked about having air around your plants and having room. But what about square foot gardening, where everything is practically on top of each other?
Yeah. I don't love square foot gardening. I practice intensive planting. So in my raised beds, there's no empty space. But I'm also growing a lot of things vertically, which gets them off the ground and allows good air to circulate. But even though I'm intensively planting, I still am not overcrowding my plants. Like, it's not just one jumble of cucumbers mixing with broccoli, mixing with tomatoes. Everything has its place. So I don't want to have any open space in the garden because, of course, that's an opportunity for Mother Nature to throw a weed at me. mulching also helps with that, of course. But I'm giving the plants the room they need to grow by planting them, you know, at a proper spacing distance. But I'm also kind of pushing it a little bit so that they can maximize production in my square footage. I don't practice square foot planting in my beds, but I do, again, intensively plant. And I do write about that in my books. I talk about how to plant close together, but not so close that you're overcrowding or your plants are competing for nutrients and water. So it's a delicate balance for sure, but it's definitely something you can learn to do.
Okay, thank you so much, Jill. We appreciate that call. And if you've got a question, the number 800-642-1234. We still have time before Nikki has to go on to another project, I'm sure. We talked about the different kinds of covers. So we talked about shade cloth, we talked about cold frames and row covers. But one we didn't talk about is the cloches or domes, the little small ones. Why don't you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, in a large garden, they're often not used quite as much as they would be in a small garden. But a cloche is basically just a cover, like a small, as you mentioned, dome cover. It could be something like an old salad container, like you bought arugula or lettuce in from the grocery store that you want to reuse in your garden. Or it could be a large glass jar. Or you can actually buy plastic or glass cloches online in a garden supply store. It's for your garden. So if you have maybe like two or three tomato plants in your garden and you've just tucked the seedlings in spring and you're a little worried about, you know, the up and down temperatures and a potential frost, you could put a cloche over top. You might remove it during the day and then pop it back over that plant at night just to offer a little bit of a microclimate and protection from the potential inclement weather. So that does work pretty well, I got to say. I've used cloches for years. I also have cloches that are made from like woven willow. So they're quite open, but they're about a foot and a half tall and a foot and a half wide. And those are fantastic for just popping over top plants to protect them from pests like deer or rabbits, or just to give them a little bit of a head start without any, you know, pressure from larger pests. So there's lots of different kinds of cloches you can find, and they're certainly useful. But if I have a raised bed full of, say, 12 tomato seedlings, I'm going to be more likely to put a mini hoop tunnel over top that bed than 12 individual cloches, just because it's less work. You know, I can just quickly pop the cover over top. I can lift the ends to allow air to flow, and then I can take it off when those tomatoes have settled in nicely and the weather is a little more consistent and warm. But cloches certainly do have their time and place.
I'd never seen a woven one, but I could definitely see where that would come in handy. Have you ever used a gallon plastic jug like milk comes in or water, cut the bottom off and put over the top? Because I've seen that before.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I do that. I do that quite a bit.
Oh,
actually.
Okay.
You know, for individual lettuces, for peppers, for basil plants in spring, things like this, I also use those gallons to winter sow seeds. So like my milkweed or even a bunch of different vegetable seeds like cabbage or broccoli, I'll sow them in January in a milk jug with a couple of inches of soil in the bottom and just toss them outside somewhere along my garden. And then, you know, come spring with the increasing temperatures and light, they germinate, and then I can just tuck them in my garden. It's a very easy way to start seeds.
Wow, that's a great idea. So then do you just cut the plastic or how do you get them out?
Yeah, well, you know, so you kind of make a little greenhouse. Mm-hmm. With the milk jug, you kind of cut almost all the way around it when you plant it, but you leave a little hinge, and then you put your soil in the bottom and plant your seeds, and then kind of keep that again. Yeah, I have a little video on YouTube about it, but there's lots of information. If you just Google how to winter sow seeds, you'll find lots of ways to do that. But it's a nice way to, again, recycle that material. You know, you could use it as a cloche in your garden, or you could use it to winter sow seeds.
Oh, I like that. That's a great idea. Jeff in Janesville, hi, what's your question?
I've been using floating row covers for a while, and I've got some 4x20 little tunnels that I'm using. What happens when it starts to get ripped up a little bit? How do you repair that?
Yeah, you know, if I have, whether it's a row cover or a piece of clear poly that I'm using for a mini hoop tunnel, I'll often just use clear packing tape or greenhouse tape, which is a little even more durable, to kind of patch it up. So I guess to make my row covers last the longest, when I put them over top my mini hoop tunnels, I don't use garden staples. Like, you can get staples or pins that poke a hole through the row cover at the base. You know, they kind of then go into the soil and hold them, you know, very sturdily to the structure, which is great, but they make holes, which become tears, which become larger holes. And so you're shortening the length you can keep that row cover for and use it in the garden. So I tend to weigh the bottoms down. I also use these things called snap clamps. And there's pictures in the book, of course, and details about what they are. But they just basically click onto the hoops, whether it's a PVC hoop or a metal hoop you're using, and it holds the covers tightly without tearing them. So I find that really lengthens their lifespan. So that's what I do. And then my row covers, sometimes they get dirty in the garden. There's lots of dirt. So I hose them off on my, on your clothesline. You can give them a little cleaning, let them dry before you either fold them for storage or put them back to work in the garden again. So taking care of your row covers is a great way to really extend their life. So that is such a good question.
Thanks, Jeff. We did get a question from Michael in Fort Atkinson, and Michelle in Fort Atkinson, and she emailed that she grew watermelon beefsteak tomatoes this year. They got great plants, but the problems are the fruit seems to be heavy for the plant itself, and also the skin seems to be very fragile, and there are lots of cracking, and it's easily damaged by being bumped. And she's wondering if you had any comments on that.
Yeah, that is. I'm glad she brought this up. That is an incredible variety. I mean, those can be 2 pounds or bigger. So like the ones I picked earlier today, the Lebanese Mountain ones. So this is where picking it early is really going to make a difference, because they're so prone to cracking when they're that big. If you wait until they're fully ripe on the vine, it's just very difficult to give them just the right amount of water that they grow healthy, but not too much that they crack. So I would pick those when they start to color up. That's called the breaker stage. So anytime after they start to show their beautiful red color, you can pick those, bring them indoors, place them in a shallow box or on a sheet of newspaper out of direct sun. Don't put them on a windowsill. And they will ripen up for you, honestly, probably in 3 or 4 days from even just being part ripe. And then you can enjoy them. And they will taste every bit as delicious, but you won't have the problems with cracking and splitting and, you know, maybe soft spots or damage. Because, you know, even when they're almost ripe, if they kind of bump against the stem or something else in the wind, then they can get damaged and bruised, and that starts to rot. So picking them before they're fully ripe and bringing them indoors to finish that process is the best way to go.
Thank you very much, Michelle, for that question. That's a really good one. Before we have to sign off, we didn't really talk about all the things that you include in your book. Why don't you kind of go through a little bit about what people can expect if they page through it?
Yeah, well, I mean, growing undercover was really a passion project for me because, as I mentioned, garden covers have been garden insurance for me growing in a short season, cold climate, and they've really helped me not only extend my harvest year-round by growing cold-tolerant vegetables in the cold season and pairing them with all these different types of season extenders, but also just preventing pests, and so many of us deal with pests. And I mean, gardeners are resilient. We know that can happen. But using these garden covers, again, as your insurance to help prevent some of those pests, insect pests, larger pests like deer and rabbits, from stealing your veggies. I don't mind sharing sometimes, but I do want to enjoy some of them myself as well. And then I go, you know, by crop to talk about how do you grow carrots for winter? How do you grow carrots using row covers? How do you do it in mulch? How do you do it in a greenhouse? So I go crop by crop to give details on exactly how to do just that, and then cover all those questions people have about watering and venting and air circulation and all of those different things that, you know, help make you a stronger, better gardener. I think as gardeners, we know there's always more to learn, no matter how much, you know, how long you've been gardening. I certainly feel that way. I'm always curious and trying to learn more, and I hope this book really helps people learn how to extend their season. We're worried about food security. You know, we're worried about access to healthy food and the rising food prices. So starting a garden is a great way. It's a starting point, obviously, of helping you take some control over that.
Well, that's a great summary of that book. And again, I highly recommend it, too, because it's got so much wonderful information. And you know that she's tried it all. So you know it's good info. So, Nikki, thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate talking to you.
Oh, it's been a delight, Jill. Thank you so much for your time. Your whole team has been amazing. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We've been talking with Nikki Jabor. She is the author of Growing Undercover: Techniques for a More Productive, Weather-Resistant, Pest-Free Vegetable Garden. And she has three other vegetable gardening books, so check out those. Also, look at her website, savvygarden.com, and her radio show, The Weekend Gardener. You can listen streaming online. Just Google The Weekend Gardener. I'm Jill Najoe. Thanks so much for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well and enjoy your weekend.